This is Barry Tyker of the University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project. Today is April 14th, year 2005. I'm in the Steenbach classroom on the third floor with Leonard Pisano. And we're going to be talking about completing an interview which Leonard began, I think, about a year or so ago and mailed in to us. We're picking it up from his approximately from his arrival here in Madison. You mentioned in your first section.
I want to say one thing.
Sure.
First, and that is, my name is Leonard Pisano, but I've never used the name Leonard.
Oh, you haven't? Okay.
No. Everybody who knows me calls me Mac.
Mac?
For Magruder is my middle name. So you can call me Mac.
I will call you Mac.
Call me Mac, and then we'll be in better shape.
Okay. okay, Mac.
Yes.
You mentioned in your first interview that the call from Madison, you got a call from Madison when you were in Italy, was that it?
I was in at Villefranche.
Oh, Villefranche,
which
Italy,
is,
yes.
Next door to Nice.
Yeah.
And where I was working, I had a Guggenheim fellowship. Yeah. And I was working there in the laboratory, and then I got a call from the department here. First of all, a letter, and then I answered, and then they were looking to fill a position that was caused when one of their people had left to go to move to Alaska, and they wanted to fill it, and apparently tried a couple of people to get and didn't get there. And then I have reconstructed afterwards what happened. They had a very distinguished biologist visiting the campus, and he was asked if he would recommend somebody, and he mentioned me. And so they thought, well, maybe. And so then they had Roland K. Meyer. R. K. Meyer was going to be in, I think, in Italy or someplace in Europe. And they asked if he could come over and meet me and talk to me about this possible job, you see.
Now, who is this distinguished person who recommended?
Ted Bullock.
Did you know him?
I knew him. I mean, he was a more senior person than I was, and, you know, I admired him.
Yeah,
and
that was supposed to be very flattering.
Yes, it was. And so I was interviewed, and apparently I passed the interview. I was full of excitement about the work that I was doing at the time, of course. And so then they asked me, would I come over to be interviewed?
Which in those days was a big deal. That was even more something.
I mean, so they flew me from Nice to Madison. And on the way, I stopped overnight in Chicago, where I stayed with my aunt and uncle, and they told me, now, you should really consider seriously going to Madison, because it's a very nice town, very nice university.
So, and you had never visited here?
I didn't know anybody.
That's
here.
Really interesting.
So they gave a good thumbs up for coming to Madison, so I came, and I must have wowed them, because when I left, they said, oh, you'll be here from us very soon, and that we're very interested. And a week or so later, I got a telephone call saying, you know, will you come? And so I did.
You know, one of the things I look at when interviews is the role that serendipity plays in people's lives.
That's
and
right.
If that professor had not been visiting campus at that particular time, your name would have probably never come out of anyone.
I was not searching for a job. I was still hoping, but rather hoping against hope, that I could get tenure at Yale.
Yeah.
I had.
Oh yeah, that's right.
I had been working on that, and thought that I'd presented myself very well to Yale, but Yale was not at all sure about me, for reasons that I think are quite realistic, that I don't publish enough. But anyway, they had put off the tenure decision. It was supposed to have been reached the previous spring. In spring of 64, and they put it off. They said, you did such a fine job of presenting your work and presenting yourself that we really considered. I mean, I read that into it.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, I'd gotten this Guggenheim Fellowship, which was another feather in one's cap.
Sure, absolutely.
So I went off to Europe to do that, and not knowing, thinking, assuming that I was coming back to Yale after the year.
Mm-hmm. And then this came up.
Then I got this offer, and mm-hmm. my wife at that time said, "Oh yes, you should take it. Don't fiddle around with Yale anymore." So I took it.
I got
tenure. I mean,
I came here with tenure, which is great.
So that solved that problem.
So that whole problem was eliminated
That's
as well.
Right.
Looking back, was that the right choice?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
I should have realized long before that Yale was really not quite my cup of tea.
Yeah, right.
But I'd been there as a graduate student, and then when your department asked you to come back, I had a fine job at the University of Washington, which is a fine university, and I could have been happy there all my life.
Yeah.
But after 2 years, they said, "Well, come back and help us." And
Yale said, "Come back."
Yale could have. So I did.
Yeah. Now, you were hired as a comparative physiologist.
Yes.
Was that your absolute field?
That was my field. The man who went to Alaska was named Peter Morrison, and he was the first, the first physiologist who had been hired by our department, because there was a department of physiology.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And you see, physiology was medical.
Mm-hmm, right.
And they thought that physiology should be taught by the physiology department, mm-hmm. but then they got this man Peter Morrison, who was more of a zoologist mm-hmm. than a medical physiologist anyway. Although he worked on mammals, he worked on hibernating mammal mm-hmm. animals and things like that. He had a very active program, Marion Meyer, who is a retired professor from zoology.
I've heard the name.
Yeah, well, she was one of Peter Morrison's students.
Oh, okay.
So I was coming to take the place of somebody who had been an mm-hmm. important mm-hmm. person in the department. Mm-hmm. They apparently didn't want to go back to the junior faculty. They wanted to keep on the momentum that Peter had built.
Yeah.
The problem was my physiology is very different from Peter's.
How was it different?
Well, he worked on mammals. He had also a philosophy of involving his students in his work and building an sort of a mini institute kind of affair, which is the proper way to do zoology. Mm-hmm. But I was not of that type. Mm-hmm. I wanted to come and do my own work, and then have students who did their own work.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to build an institute.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to teach and teach my philosophy of teaching comparative physiology, but not leading a group into higher things. Well, I think that I was a disappointment to the department in that sense, because I was not following that pattern.
Well, we'll talk. Your teaching was a very big part of your career.
Well, my teaching was always part of
it. Yeah, and we have a special section for that, so we'll get to that a little bit later.
Well, anyway, that's...
Why did that Peter, what's his last name?
Peter Morrison.
Why did he go to Alaska?
Well, I think he felt he could work better on hibernating mammals in Alaska than he could...
I think they
offered him his own institute of some sort.
And this was at the University of Alaska?
But it never worked out for Peter. I mean, he was not an easy person to work for, I understand, although I have never met him.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun. He made friends and made enemies sort of at about equal numbers.
Yeah.
And he ended up, I mean, his rest of his career was in Alaska, but he never really was happy there, and he kept trying to move away.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So, anyway.
That's far away. Way up there.
Yeah. In the meantime, I found that I was very happy being in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
The most important thing to me, I may have mentioned it to you, was the faculty governance.
Yeah.
I felt that was very important, that to build up a proper university with all the attitudes that I hoped they would have in its own esprit,
mm-hmm.
that it was important to involve the faculty in the governance ways of doing things. And and that was what I didn't like at Yale.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
There was essentially no, the junior faculty had no role.
Yeah.
in governance at Yale. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were allowed to come to some meetings, but otherwise we were never asked. Mm-hmm. We didn't vote for anything. Mm-hmm. The senior members of the department ran the whole department. And it was a good deal of politics, of course, as there are as everywhere. And so I didn't like at Yale. I felt it was not being responsible for the idea of a university which involved everyone. Came to Wisconsin, it's very different.
Now, we were going to talk about that later, but let's do it now since you brought it up. Let's talk about faculty governance at the department level and at the university level, because you were involved, I know, as a senator at the university level.
I was involved at the university. I never became a departmental chair. I actually was nominated once, I think, but I'm not really enough of a, well, it would probably not have been a good thing for me in the first place, let's put it that way. I think I found my niche of being a contributing member of the department, involved in the departmental activities and trying to contribute to them, but I'm not truly a leader in that sense. And then I felt that at the university level that I could make a contribution as a senator, take the role of a departmental representative in the Senate as a serious job, try to always be the bridge between the activities that was going on there and Bascom and so on. And so I felt that I did make a contribution to that. Then I also got involved in as a member of the University Library Committee, which I found a challenge and was interested in. That's how I came over to Steenbach many times.
You had mentioned that you're familiar with this library.
I not only used it as a library resource, but I also was involved in a lot of decision making from the library and in Steenbach and the whole dynamics of the. Of the library situation here. You see, zoology was co-sponsor of the biology library. And there still is a biology library here on this campus in Burge Hall.
Right.
And so I was quite significantly involved in as being the zoology department person involving the biology library. And then I got into the university library the same way through a series of committees. I was on appointments committees, and then I became sort of a member of the university library committee. Eventually I became the chair of the university library committee. And
that's an important role.
Well, that is.
The library is the heart of the university.
I feel that the library is very key to the whole university. And we had some very good librarians at that time. There was also some pulls between, particularly between School of Agriculture and part of the and LNS, as to how should biology. Of course, some people want just to take biology and put it into the new enlarged ag school, and then that caused a lot of division within my department. But some of the a minority wanted to do that, but the majority wanted to maintain their role in LNS and be a teaching department within LNS. And so there were these problems. And then they spilled over into the library questions. People wanted to, people said, well, let's just abandon the biology library. Yeah. We don't need it. That's an anachronism. Anyway, so I was involved in that, and then they built the new wing Schlichter Hall.
Yeah,
incidentally, I had a high school college friend who was in Schlichter, who came from that family.
Oh, really? Yeah, that was quite a family.
Charles Schlichter was a physicist who eventually went to the University of Illinois.
Yeah, they were all over, weren't they? Yeah.
Anyway, so it was a familiar name when I came here. But I was on head of the library committee when they built the enlargement.
And then
we had problems about the siting and its
We ought to explain that. They added some floors. Yeah. I think it became 8. It was going to be 10 originally.
Yeah.
But there's this thing that you have to be able to see the Capitol from the top of Bascom Hall. And it symbolizes the relationship between the university and the state. And, you know, there is something to be said for that.
So,
and there was a huge, you were in the middle of that. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, that was a very interesting experience because you could see the very power of things that were going.
Who were the powers pushing for the higher one?
Do
you remember?
I don't remember that much. The administration,
library administration?
No,
I think the
library administration felt they were a little bit out of it.
It was
the central administration.
Okay,
Bascom that thought, we can do this. We should go up and never mind this all this foolishness. And then I had a colleague in the botany department named Hugh Iltis, who was quite a leader in many ways, but a very active, opinionated person. He felt very strongly about this. That was not the first of the minor crises that we faced, but it was quite. I can remember Hugh taking me up to Bascom High on the hill, just by the chancellor's office, just outside the window there, and then said, "Now look."
I remember going up myself and standing. Yeah. I think there were a lot of people on this campus who did that.
There were.
as symbols go, it's a great symbol. And it is really about the only place you can find that.
Well, anyway, that was. Then I got involved. And the last part of what I hoped to do was to convince the university administration to be more supportive of publication by the university press.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, our university press does not really have a central role in publishing science, and we should work more to publish science and to counter the increasing centralization of scientific publication among for-profit entrepreneurial types who are essentially going to price us out of the whole business of scientific publication.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to get them to do that. And then,
did you have any success?
No.
I was going to say, I don't remember them doing a whole lot of scientific publications.
No, they were very firmly not going to touch that.
Yeah.
They thought it was too big a problem, they said. And the head of the library, Kenneth
Fraser.
Fraser.
Ken still had library.
He was very fine. I was on his search committee.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll mention that.
Very pleased. Very pleased because he's a fine leader in the library, I think.
Yeah.
But so I was trying to convince him and actually his predecessor too. His name, I can't remember.
Gateman.
Yes. Yeah, that she should go to Washington and get a group of Midwest universities, for example, to serve as a power point for combating Springer-Verlag. But that was my interest in that, because I could see the costs of subscriptions to these essential tools for the library were just
they're getting just more and more through the roof. I hear the prices on some of those medical things, and I can't believe that I'm hearing the figures that I'm hearing.
No, they're just
now, getting back to your service component, when we were walking before...
That shows where my mind is going.
Well, I showed you where to park, and we were talking outside, and you really enjoyed your job as a senator, didn't you?
I did.
A lot of people see that as sort of a task that you have. It's sort of like being chairman sometimes. You just have to do these things for a few years, and so you can move on. And
I found it enjoyable, because I felt I had found something that I could make a contribution to. That I took seriously.
Yeah.
I'm not one that gets up and speaks very often.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I probably spoke in the Senate maybe half a dozen times in the years that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd take notes and I'd make a report and I'd actually write out a report and to the department and circulate it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would write a brief report. This is what the Senate did at its last meeting, and this is why it's important to us, and so on.
So, that's great.
I found it was...
That's great.
I took it seriously when most people did not. And to some degree, I think, wasn't sure that the administration took it as seriously as I did.
Yeah.
They went through the motions of it, and I think they took it somewhat seriously, but they did not really see the Senate as a body being a very powerful thing. They thought there were certain leaders in the Senate that had to be.
I see, yeah.
You know, but anyway, that was my
opinion. That's great.
Now, compare that to the graduate school. Bach, do you remember?
Oh, yeah, Dean Bach. Yeah.
Well, he was a person who I thought did not believe in faculty governance. And I went to a number of meetings where he essentially just pushed through his own agenda and didn't pay any, I felt, paid much attention to the people.
Mm-hmm.
He finally just essentially abolished the graduate school senate, you know, or whatever it was called.
Mm-hmm.
We had a thing. He just didn't want to be bothered with that, and so he pushed them aside, went and did his own thing.
He was there for quite a long time.
He was there for a long time, and he was a very powerful leader in the graduate school and very important. But I think I didn't like that aspect of his leadership because I felt he did not take advantage of the collegiality.
Sure.
That's one of the
strengths of the Senate.
That was my feeling anyway.
In the interview you did a while back, you talked a little bit, and some of it was never completed, about the splitting of the department. And one of your lines, one of the sentences that you that I'm quoting you here is, the splitting of the department was a major problem for the department.
Yes.
Could you talk about why the department was split up and how that impacted on you and the various units of the department?
The semester, I arrived in the fall of 64. Mm-hmm. And that was the time that a third of the department left Burge Hall and went to their new building, the Zoology Research Building, which had been built by a group of the professors in the department and pushed for them as a sort of way of breaking out of the confines of Burge Hall, which was not adequate. I was never asked, did I want to go? It had already been decided, you see. Peter Morrison had said he was going to stay in Burge Hall and take over space that was vacated. So when I came,
that makes sense.
It was just assumed that I would stay in Burge Hall.
Yeah.
But the problem was that the major intellectual contacts that I should have had and would have normally pursued in the department had left.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sort of left in one part of the department where I should have been. The physiologist should have been in that other building along with the other people who went over there.
Boy, and that's critical.
So that more or less reinforced the a division in the department.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Zoo Research Group and the Burge Hall Group then became two separate divisions, and as a group, they identified themselves as the new biology on one hand, and the traditional zoology on the other.
Oh my!
You see,
that's almost like two departments.
Well, it is. For a while, it was nearly two departments, and in fact, at some points, we actually had one chairman and two vice chairmen, representing the two.
Yeah.
And there was talk about how the Zoo Research Building people were going to move into join the ag school and become, because that was where molecular biology was centered, you see. And the Molecular Biology Institute that Bach built had a couple of people from our department who were then housed neither in Zoo Research nor in Burge, but in the Molecular Biology Building.
Oh, yeah.
So now the department was even more split up.
These
different groups would come together for departmental meetings and talks, but still, intellectually, we were sort of divided. Yeah. And that was unfortunate.
Yeah.
They kept talking about how they were going to build another building that would move the rest of us in Burge, out of Burge, down to Noland. Mm-hmm. And they build essentially a third building that would house the rest of us, that would more or less correspond to the Sober Search building. And so the department essentially would be rejoined.
Yeah.
That never, never happened.
It seems odd that they would have made that decision in the first place to build a separate building, knowing that half of the department...
Yeah. It was several blocks away.
Oh, yeah. That's another thing for people listening to this.
Yeah.
Burge Hall is right up near Bascom on Bascom Hill. And the new Zoll was over on Johnson Street.
Yes.
Is that? Yeah. And so that's a two or three... And in the course of a day, it might as well be a mile away, because you can't just jump over there.
You don't see your colleagues.
Yeah,
I mean,
you don't walk down the hall.
You're not having lunch.
You don't have a cup of coffee or anything like that. Yeah.
Our teaching was down in what became Noland Hall,
mm-hmm.
the teaching building, and so because that was the Noland was not built first. You see, the Zoll Research Building was built first.
Okay,
and then they built Noland Hall, but it was strictly as a teaching building.
There were some staff
in there. They had the departmental office. They moved the machine shop and the electronic shop from Burge
to
Noland.
Okay, gotcha.
They had the stock room, which for a while we had a stock room in Burge as well as a stock room in Noland, but then they had to give that up, and so we had our stockroom in Noland. So the departmental artist was there in Noland. All of these facilities you see were in Noland, but the Zoll Research Building became essentially a wing of Noland, connected at several floors.
Yeah.
So they
had the advantage.
They had the advantage
there too.
But the people in Burge did not. The only thing that Burge Hall had was the library.
Yeah. Well, that's not bad.
So you can understand even more why when they talked about, oh, well, let's give up the library and have that in Steenbach, we said,
that,
no.
Oh, that's your, that was your last ace. Yeah.
So, yeah. And then our library was in the east end of Burge Hall.
Okay.
And then they built it, the new wing, the new facility, which was built on the footprint of animal quarters, animal houses that were built there at that end of Burge Hall. They were all torn down, and then they put the biology library there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was very much involved in the design and things of that.
That's,
we got in the middle of it, and we were almost in the construction phase, and we discovered that they had changed in the plans. They had decided that they would have heating pipes of high pressure steam come up in the middle of the library, which were not supposed to be.
Oh no!
And we blocked it. Hugh Wilson and I were able to stop that construction and get them to change those plans.
Yeah, that could have been a disaster.
Oh, sure. That was another one of the things where you were fighting, essentially.
So let me see if I have this right now. The traditionalists, I use that term kind of loosely, remained in Burge Hall.
The sort of. Systemic biologists, systematists, and the ecology people, the invertebrate teaching was all in Burge Hall.
Yeah.
Plus, comparative physiology.
Yeah.
Physiology would normally be considered.
You're the odd man out.
Yeah, you're the bridge.
See,
I'm a bridge, in a sense, but I'm not. I don't think I was very much of a bridge person anyway.
Yeah.
Because my loyalties were for zoology as a discipline, and rather than abandoning that and becoming a molecular biologist, I didn't feel myself as a molecular biologist. I saw more affinities of my interest with animal behavior, which remained in Burge Hall,
Now, when you people all eventually got together again, did that division that had been that artificial division that had been created by space, did that continue, or did that
it, dissipate? They never have completely, at least up to the time I departed, there was still that basic division in the department. The department was still basically divided among the modern biologists as they could thought of themselves, the molecular oriented and genetically oriented and cytologically oriented biologists on one hand, and the animal behaviorists, the invertebrate biologists, the ecologists. They were in the old, and so this is a division which has gone through biology and throughout the country. I mean, it's not something that just happened here, because many biology departments actually divided themselves.
They were divided.
At Harvard, for example, they divided biology into two departments.
That's very interesting.
And a lot of other places did the same thing. But
is that sort of like an identity crisis in a sense? As biology became
more and more molecular, more and more biochemical, okay, the division between the field biology and the laboratory biology became palpable.
I mean, so something that was palpable anyway was made even more.
But
so
then,
by
then in our department, we had this physical division.
Right, the physical makes it even much more dramatic.
So and, a number of my colleagues thought, well, the only logical thing to do is to divide us up into two departments, but they never could quite. And comparative physiology is, unfortunately, straddling. I mean, it's straddling this division.
Oh, my goodness.
It really is.
Oh, my goodness.
So, anyway.
Okay, you were mentioning.
Well, what I was saying was that biology as a discipline outgrew its roots, and became much broader, and people quite seriously think if you want to read about it in spades, you can read about the conflict between James Watson, the DNA man, and Edward Wilson,
ant man. Yeah.
Well, they were both at Harvard at the same time, and they represented two disparate views of way biology should go, and neither one of them would really talk to the other, and neither one of them thought the other was worth anything. Well, they had somewhat mellowed now, I think, but even so, the molecular biologists were very cocky that they were going to, they were the future of biology, and that all that rest was just stamp collecting. I mean, that's the term, stamp collecting.
Yeah.
So we had in a small echo of that here at Wisconsin, between the different parts of the department, of the zoology department.
But isn't that just sort of something that would kind of come with the territory as you're expanding into new ground?
People are kind of claiming that they're the
future, and
it is. But there was such a field change in biology when molecular biology became
interesting.
It sort of started growing up.
Yeah.
So now I compare it to the botany department. Why didn't the botany department have this same problem? And the answer is that the botanists felt, I think, defensive. Botany as a discipline has to be look after itself. No one else is going to take care of it. Zoology, as the other part of biology, always has medical school. The pre-med students. Pre-med students always gave a nice, easy excuse for funding, space, more staff, and so on. So the botany department is nationally, internationally, would have to defend its own turf against the invaders. That is,
You know, we don't want to be a biology department because that means that zoology will run things.
Yeah.
We want to have our own separate department. Yeah. And so the people within the botany department attended to get together and hold hands because they had to fight off the invaders. Zoology didn't ever had that.
That's
feeling.
Very interesting.
And they had to. Zoologists would say, "Oh well, why don't let's forget about this zoology as an old concept anyway. We're all biologists. Let's all do it together."
Oh, that's interesting.
That's what happened.
Now you again, one other little mention, then we'll move on here. You mentioned Watson and Crick is the other one, of course. Yeah. And you were in Cambridge when they were there.
Yes, yes.
Could you talk? I know you mentioned it just briefly in passing in the last tape. Could you elaborate on a little bit, and are there any anecdotes you can relate of situations?
Well, I can remember one anecdote, which I'll share with you. I was in from 1952 to 53. I had a postdoctoral fellowship at Cambridge University. I'd gotten my PhD from Yale in 1952, and I applied for a job, never interviewed for it because they didn't interview for instructors in those days. At Seattle, Washington, and I was offered this job. But then I said, but I've also put in an application for a National Science Foundation postdoctoral fellowship. It was the first year that they offered these fellowships, and there were four in biology. And I got one of them, because I came from Yale, I think that was but I was a good student. And so I turned down the people at Washington, and I went to Cambridge University. I wanted to go over in the summer, but the man I was going to work with was going to be in Brazil. So he said, "Well, no, I can't. We can't get together until the end of the summer, beginning of the fall." But I said, "Okay, that's all right. I'll do something else." And I went off to Naples, and there's a famous zoological station in Naples called Stazione Zoologica di Napoli. And I went there and worked for the summer on a project of my own, by myself. It was a great disappointment when I got to Naples because, in spite of my Italian name, I don't have any Italian blood or language or anything else. I mean, it's generations ago. You know? So I could not be that. But I made friends with English-speaking people in Naples, and one of the people that I got to know well was a young biologist named Murdoch Mitchison, who he and his wife were down there working at the station. Well, they were from Cambridge. So when I went, after the end of the summer, when I went up back to Cambridge to meet Carl Panton, who I was to work with, I had these friends in Cambridge, the Mitchisons. Well, Murdoch is still a very bright, well-connected zoologist. His uncle was J.B.S. Haldane. His mother was Haldane's sister, Naomi Mitchison.
Oh my goodness!
And his father was an MP. He was obviously in the intellectual high ranks of, you know, I didn't know about that. I just knew he was a friend.
Yeah.
But he returned his friendship, and we became longtime friends. I'm still a friend of his. And so that got me into going into a little different pathways in Cambridge when I was there. And one of the people that Murdoch knew well were Watson and Crick, young Turks. Who were doing very exciting things.
Absolutely.
So I got to know Jim Watson and Francis Crick through Murdoch Mitchison. And the anecdote was that one day in, I think in March of 53, I had a date to play squash with Jim Watson. So I went over to play with Jim. He was a better squash player than I was. Anyway, but I played with him, and he told me at the end, Francis and I have just submitted a paper to Nature. We think it's really going to shake up things. I said, "Wow." you look for it, said Jim. And I said, "Okay, I will. Exciting."
Boy, that was an understatement.
I mean, yes, you know, in hindsight, you wonder, how could you But actually, for the first 6 months or a year, I was very worried about the universality of the DNA structure that they predicted, proposed, and not only that, the universality of it through the entire animal and plant kingdom and all of life. That seemed to me was a wild oversimplification. Mm. How could you be sure that anything would have such a thing? Well, they were sure. Yeah. They knew from their perspective that this was what it was, that it was really going to be it.
Do you remember reading that Nature article when it came out? What were your thoughts when you read it?
Well, it's convincing. It sounds right, but...
But can it spread through the entire...
I wonder if they really know exactly what they're doing. Yes, later on when I taught biology for non-majors, mm-hmm. I gave them that. Every fall I would give them a Xerox copy of that paper and say, now this is history, this is the way it happened.
That's great.
And it was just a couple of people with a new idea and seeing through to it.
Yeah. Well, among scientists, that was just, it's sort of like saying, what were you doing when you heard that Kennedy was assassinated? What were you doing when you heard about...
Well, you're exactly right. And it also points out that my entire graduate career was pre Watson and Crick.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
I mean, you see, everything that I learned as an undergraduate and then as a graduate student at Yale predated that breakthrough.
Wow.
I went to lectures with Joshua Lederberg, who later on was taught here, who was a graduate student in the botany department at Yale, and listened to him, and I went to, they had meetings on the role of DNA, but people were arguing about what role, if any, did DNA play.
Yeah.
And the biochemist who I learned biochemistry from was Joseph Frutan, who was a very distinguished biochemist. But he was very skeptical about that DNA had any significant role in biology.
That's interesting.
Proteins must be the, you know.
Well, everybody had their own little area that they were in a sense.
They just didn't see how there could be any complexity built into the DNA molecule.
Yeah. When did that start to change?
Didn't really start until after Watson.
After Watson,
I mean, they were the ones that essentially opened up.
They brought the question to the floor. Essentially,
they said, "Now look, here is a way in which biological complexity, the complexity of living things, can be encoded in the genome." Before that, people didn't have any idea that DNA was more than just a scaffolding that would hold proteins in certain positions.
How exciting.
Well, it was very, that whole period was extremely exciting from that perspective. But this is the background that then made the people here in our department in the 60s and the early 70s think that those people that didn't come up with this new idea, they missed the boat.
So it becomes sort of the new messiah.
I know what you mean. I know what you're saying. This is why biology really had a...
Fascinating.
Well, anyway.
Fascinating. And you were saying...
I was going to say one of the appeals of Madison was that it combined on one campus a medical school and a agricultural school. Mm-hmm. And of course, most universities, those are separated into different different universities. And here, zoology as an undergraduate department and a teaching in the LNS could interact with medical departments. Mm-hmm. And I always found that was a very strong thing for me. And biology just had to go back and forth. So I could go to anatomy and physiology and biochemistry and genetics. All of these departments had ties with zoology, and we had. Well, Jim Crow was a distinguished geneticist who was a member of our department in zoology.
Right.
A very important contributor to the department leadership. That was the kind of thing that I found was the strength of Madison.
Yeah, that's great.
So, I'd like to emphasize that. Yeah.
Now, you came to Madison in...
64.
And there are some hot times coming down the pike in Madison. We have the Vietnam protest movement, we have a TA strike, we have the black student strike, we have a lot of things like that. Could you talk about what the campus was like in that political sense when you arrived, and how it changed and how it affected you and perhaps even your department?
Well, I am a liberal Democrat, mm-hmm. But I'm not really an activist, mm-hmm. too much when it comes to going out and leading, holding the flag on, mm-hmm. on the barriers. But I was able to empathize with these different groups. Mm-hmm. However, I was very upset about the Vietnam protest, not because I didn't think that there was something to protest, but I didn't feel that this was the right way one should be posed to. I mean, I'm more of a pacifist type, mm-hmm. than not a bomb thrower. And we were, I think many people in my department had sympathies, mm-hmm. for this position, the position against the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. but still didn't feel that we should be leading the mm-hmm. the march. Mm-hmm. You see, our job was to do biology, mm-hmm. and to, right. teach students and have bring them along, and it became increasingly difficult to maintain an atmosphere of learning and collegiality, mm-hmm. when you had these big divisions,
yeah, right.
swirling around on the campus. And so that was something that I was concerned about and worked on. I tried to encourage people to participate but not to give up their own science for the, mm-hmm. political things. Some people were saying, you know, politics is everything. We can't. We don't, mm-hmm. have. We can't afford to do this science. It's too isolated, yeah. from reality.
Right.
We have to put ourselves. So I had some students who were one way and some were the other. I had a student named Michael Oberdorfer who was a leftist. Mm-hmm. He got arrested by the police. Mm-hmm. I had to go and bail him out. I had to sign warrants saying that I would make sure that he was behaving himself and so on. That was all right, mm-hmm. and I don't mind doing that. And I did participate in the march to the Capitol, mm-hmm. you know, with holding the candles and, mm-hmm. and things like that. I didn't feel that this was my primary role,
right.
here in the university. My,
right.
primary role was to teach the students, mm-hmm. and try to maintain, mm-hmm. our curriculum and our, mm-hmm. things. And I was primarily thinking in terms of graduate school students at that time, how to preserve the atmosphere of scholarship and mm-hmm. study that we were trying to inculcate into the graduate students. So that was a difficulty. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, the bombing,
yeah.
and the bombing disrupted everything. And it blew all the windows out the side of Birch Hall. And,
it did. It affected Birch Hall.
You see,
yeah.
the physics building was right.
Right,
next,
Sterling Hall.
The physics,
right.
building was right next door.
Mm-hmm. Of course, that would have gone.
So they did a lot of damage. Our labs were, if not destroyed, were mm-hmm. endangered. Some people lost equipment and records and so on, and then out of that we got a lot of goods because they came back and said, "No, you have. We haven't spent all the money that we have been given to, mm-hmm. equip our labs. Is there something that you got lost that you haven't told us about?" And then the next question was, "Is there something that you might have had, but actually didn't." So I fell for that, in the sense I got, I said, well, this, as a group, as a floor on Birch Hall, we need an analytical balance, which mm-hmm. we never had. Mm-hmm. We didn't have enough money for that. Mm-hmm. But I think we could have had an analytical balance. So they put in one analytical balance for Mac Bassano in his lab, and I took it, but I said it must be understood that this is for everybody. Mm-hmm. So I always made it available to everybody in Birch Hall who wanted to use this piece of equipment. I kept it working and, you know, called in the technician to have it fixed every few months and so on. But that was
that was one of the things that
came as, shall we say, as a bonus from
Sterling
Hall.
Nice to know that some good things sort of happened in indirect ways, at least, well, during that very difficult period.
It was. And then of course, we got involved in the labor movement for the graduate students.
Yeah,
and
the TA strike.
And the TA strike.
Yeah.
And I thought our department behaved very properly in mm-hmm. that. We had members of the TA who were leaders in the strike, mm-hmm. and we acknowledged that they had a role to play in that way. We didn't necessarily agree with it. Some people strongly disagreed with the idea of having TAs have a union. I felt that it was tricky, but probably better to have a union. Mm-hmm. But we paid attention to the graduate student leaders of the TA in our department and honored them for that mm-hmm. and had asked them to come to our meetings mm-hmm. and participate in the departmental affairs to that extent before the union was recognized. So I think in our department did a proper thing mm-hmm. in the way it tried to welcome the changes mm-hmm. and try to make them mm-hmm. as usable as possible, mm-hmm. put it that way.
From your perspective, I know there are certain departments were reputed to have not treated their TAs very well, and that was one of the precipitating factors. How did your department generally treat
Zoology
TAs?
In general treated their people well. So I don't think that TAs at that time or subsequently would have really felt that our department was unfair to them. We tended to support our graduate students. The graduate students were tended to be thought of as in terms of being constituents of the different laboratories that were centered around the different senior faculty. Mm-hmm. And of course, they would like to. Many of the department felt that TAs and RAs should really be working on the graduate students, on the university's, mm-hmm. on the professor's research, and have a team work for research. And the TAs and RAs would be parts of that team. Now, I, as I told you before, insisted that any students who worked with me would have to work on their own project.
Right.
So I supported people working on individual projects mm-hmm. In the general rubric of comparative physiology, but not in any sense being members of my mm-hmm. group, my laboratory.
Your research group, okay.
So that was the difference, I would say. But I think in general, the zoology department was fair and considerate of its graduate students.
And that may be why it worked out well.
I think so. I mean,
for you too.
And even people in our department who were quite strongly opposed to the idea of having of unionization were willing to listen to individuals mm-hmm. and go along with that collective decision, which was a good thing.
Good. Let's turn to your research for a while.
Yeah.
How much was when you arrived? How much was research stressed by the department, especially on new people like yourself? Of course, you came here in a tenured position. So
I came
that was
here
a little
in a
different.
Tenured position was somewhat different. I inherited a laboratory, mm-hmm. which was not very appropriate for my needs, but mm-hmm. which I could then turn into one for my own purposes, mm-hmm. And I inherited a teaching role in the department. Mm-hmm. I was to teach comparative physiology. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I essentially recast that into a new course that I taught, a And then after a few years, I was joined in that effort by Marion Meyer, who was hired as a part-time teacher, and she and I collaborated on the teaching of comparative physiology for the all the remaining years of my here.
That's nice.
Here. And she is living in University Heights right now, so you can talk to her sometime. She's had a very interesting career. So she and I were together taught comparative physiology and shared in the development of a very, I think, creative laboratory that we organized with it. And we taught it as basically a required course for seniors who would be sort of integrate the various aspects of biology that they had learned as undergraduates at the senior level.
So getting back to the research, you didn't feel the pressure that you would have if you would have been trying to earn tenure.
No, when I first came, I had three papers that were just coming out. So I had a significant body of research that I had written and done, and then I was going off in a slightly different direction, but not significantly one, to continue the work that I had been doing at Yale. While I was at Yale, I actually had two lines of work. One was working on crustacean hormones, because I had written my graduate thesis on crustacean endocrinology and worked on molting hormone in crustaceans. And then when I was back at Yale, I continued to do some work with molting hormones, using primarily crabs as my organism. And then I started developing studies on the behavioral physiology of crustaceans, behavioral physiology of cylindrates, which to me meant jellyfish and hydra, the freshwater polyp. So I worked on the freshwater polyp, and I worked on cyphomedusae, which are the large jellyfish. And when I came to Madison, I continued both of these for several years, and I actually had a couple of students who followed up on the endocrinology questions that I was working on with crustaceans, but then I discouraged people further from that. I said, I don't have enough biochemical expertise to follow that line. And that's why I chose to drop that eventually, because I didn't feel I was enough of a biochemist. I wanted to be more of a behavioral physiologist, which meant that I could study whole organisms and try to interpret and understand the controls for their behavior in terms of the neurophysiology of their nervous system. Now, cylindrates have very simple nervous systems. They don't have any brain. They don't have any ganglia, which you can say that's where the behavior comes from. They have a sort of interlocking felt work of nerve cells. The cylindrates represent the group of animals that are the simplest in terms of having a nervous system. So if we're going to understand the control of behavior of cylindrates, we have to understand how this nervous system works. And that was the basic question that I put myself to. And I continued working here both with hydra, which is a freshwater organism and easy to keep in the laboratory, and I tried to maintain some contacts with marine organisms by developing a facility here in the department where I could keep marine animals, and also every summer I would go to a marine station and work at that station. And many summers I went back to the West Coast and worked at the University of Washington Marine Laboratory at Friday Harbor, which is a wonderful place to work. So I was working on various kinds of jellyfish, both large and small, and I was working with Hydra as a freshwater organism that I could work with more easily here in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to bring marine animals also to work here in Madison.
What kind of questions generally were your students working on?
They were attracted also to this idea of trying to understand the control, in the broadest sense, the control mechanisms for behavioral modification, behavioral control of animals. I had a very fine student who unfortunately eventually faded away and was able to continue his work many years after he left here and had his doctorate. But he worked on the behavior of fiddler crabs.
Mm-hmm.
And we had colonies of fiddler crabs down in the basement of Burge Hall. Mm. And you're studying how they behaved in terms of light regimens and feeding and that sort of thing. So that was the kind of thing. We were looking at the somewhat simplistic ways in which animals modify their behavior and control their behavior in respect to the way they live.
Now, the lab, tell me a little bit about your lab. I've never been in any of the labs in that part of the campus. You inherited this from...
I inherited a laboratory, and then after we decided to move the teaching to Noland, when mm-hmm. Noland was completed, mm-hmm. we designed laboratory facilities in Noland for our teaching,
mm-hmm.
and then that left the teaching facility across the corridor from where my lab had been.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved my lab over across the hall into that new vacated space and reconstructed the teaching facility into my laboratory.
Mm-hmm. And your students would work out of your lab, generally speaking?
I had some things for the students, but then I had other facilities for mm-hmm. the students themselves. So the students would have their own
mm-hmm.
space. They would use some of the facilities that I had mm-hmm. in terms of observation rooms I had a little shop.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was in charge of the departmental student shop
mm-hmm.
one floor above. Mm-hmm. So we had these kinds of facilities.
Oh, I see. That's interesting.
So I would try to do that. Then we had next door to my laboratory.
Okay, let's begin. You said you had some computer facilities.
One of the students that came to me was a very bright young biologist who had got his undergraduate training at MIT.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And his name is Daniel Smith. And Dan had been intrigued by computers.
Mm-hmm.
This was the early days of computing at MIT. So when he came here, he still had these interests in computing, he was my student, and he was going to work on a behavioral physiology problem, a comparative physiology problem, and eventually he chose to work on the behavior of sea urchins
mm-hmm.
down in the Caribbean
mm.
and how they behave over. Day-night cycle, and they move around, and they come together into aggregates, and then they separate out. And he did a lot of the studies of that mm-hmm. sort down in the Dutch West Indies Curaçao, and so I supported that and. But then he also was interested in the computing, emerging computing scene on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually he said, I think the department ought to have its own computer.
Oh.
And we can get this computer, which is being abandoned by some other facility, it's being too small.
Mm-hmm.
So we got this computer, the smallest independent computer facility that could exist. And we moved it over to Burge Hall and built a zoology computer facility.
Oh, you did.
Which we called Bozo.
Biology.
I don't.
I don't know. Biology and zoology computer or something like that. Anyway.
Well, about when was this?
Now I'll have to think about it. I would say it was in the late 70s, early 80s.
That would make sense. So continue.
It was just before the time that people started having computers of their own.
That would have been 80, 81, we started getting our individual PCs.
Well, before that.
PCs.
Just before that.
So late 70s would be right.
When PCs had not yet emerged as the way in which biologists essentially would compute. We were still going to a facility and using punch cards and
that kind of thing.
And you were still supposed to write your own programs.
Yes, right.
Fortran.
Yeah.
And,
yes. Yeah.
That was that period. Mm-hmm. It was an interval period.
Yeah.
And I had also been trying to use some of the elementary computer facilities for my own research. Mm-hmm. And so Dan had this idea of having a departmental computer facility. And for several years, we built it up. And he taught courses to graduate students on how to program and how to run things. And then all of a sudden, the PC became obviously the way in which people who were not interested in computing would go.
Yeah. But you got a little jump.
Well, we got a little jump, and the department got a little jump on that.
I think that's good.
And they developed the animal behaviorists in our department were able to figure out ways of transcribing their observational data and then to analyze it using our computer. And that was...
So you started seeing some of the advantages. Yeah,
that's how it was used. And then I got a PC, and then I could go on from there.
Everything changed in a lot of ways.
Well, Dan... after getting his doctorate in zoology, and he certainly was one of the brightest, best graduate students I ever had, has spent his entire life working in the computer business.
Oh my goodness!
he works in near Boston as a computer specialist in software and development. So I mean that was really what he wanted to do, and was. But he still had that training as a zoologist, which I think...
That's a nice training. That would be very helpful.
And interestingly enough, one of the papers that he wrote as a result of his doctoral work was done for Ted Bullock. So he still maintains
these connections.
These loose connections. He was one of the...
Yeah.
And so I was essentially a departmental... staff person or faculty person who supervised that, of course, during those years.
When PCs, by the way, for people listening to this 50 years from now, that means personal computers.
Right.
When the PCs first came out, I remember there being IBM versus Apple. People were wondering, was that ever a question in your department? Or was that an L&S decision? Or
that was a little bit later. The actual first computer. Well, anyway, the first computer that I got was an IBM PC, and it was, of course, it was before you had a you were still using floppy floppies, and you had to load your programs into the PC using floppies,
right,
and moving them back and forth. I mean that kind of thing. A hard disk. I don't know if there was any hard disk, or if it was, it was so small that it couldn't be used for that purpose in those early years. And the Mac as an alternative to PC, I came a little bit later.
I think. And that would have been your Illustrator and people like that.
That's right.
They would have gotten
Macintosh computers because they were more appropriate for that kind of thing,
graphic stuff, artist stuff. In terms of the funding for your research, when you came here, you inherited the lab, you inherited the position. Did you inherit any funding, or how did you go about getting your early funding, and how did that change over the course of your years at the university?
Well, I over the first, I would say, 10 years of being here, continued to get support from the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. I was getting grants,
and writing renewals, getting that.
You mean continued from what you had before you came here?
Okay. Yeah. So I had been getting that support at Yale, and I brought it with me and continued. Gradually, that dried up as far as I was concerned, because I wanted to try to keep getting support for my students, and I was trying to write grant proposals that were so general, mm-hmm. and they kept saying, no, you have to concentrate on your own work. We'll support your own work, mm-hmm. but we won't support student work. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, but the students are not doing my work. Mm-hmm. The students are doing their own work. Mm-hmm. And so I reached that problem. I was not willing to have my students become my lab technicians.
Right. Yeah.
I didn't feel that was the right way to do it, and they didn't want to support graduate students just per se. Now, very sophisticated biologists are able to get around this by somehow writing broad grant proposals mm-hmm. that they could then mm-hmm. incorporate their students into. But my feeling was that was not, well, anyway, I didn't do it then.
That wasn't a game you wanted to play.
So then eventually I was basically just being supported by graduate school mm-hmm. grants, mm-hmm. but they were relatively small, mm-hmm. and I would be able to get a little bit of grant support for one student or another mm-hmm. and that way. But so eventually the grant support eventually mm-hmm. died.
Yeah, became more difficult and died.
And when I recognized that I was no longer being competitive in terms of pushing my research in terms of money, grant support, I then recognized that if I was going to continue to be in the department, I had to find an alternative, and that's when I decided to do more teaching.
Okay. And we're going to get to that in just 1 minute, because
that was
a critical choice, and you recognized
I could recognize that I had to make that decision, and I felt that was the decision that was right for me.
Now, you were published, you had many publications, a list of I can't remember how many. Were there any that were of importance, that were of particular importance to you or to your field?
Well, I collaborated with a friend named George Mackey, M-A-C-K-I-E. He was at the University of Alberta, mm-hmm. and then he moved to University of Victoria in British Columbia. Mm-hmm. He's an Englishman, came from Oxford originally, who had gone to Canada and to continue his teaching, and then went to Victoria, where he completed his teaching and his research. And Mackey was very interested in selenorates, and we worked together. In fact, the year of the Guggenheim that I had, I went with George and the two of us together. He had another leave, and I had the Guggenheim, and I worked with him. And what I did then was to teach him how to use electrophysiological instrumentation on simple animals like jellyfish. Mm-hmm. And he had the ideas and the background and the feeling and the understanding of structure and the function of these animals, so that he could ask questions and we could collaborate with mm-hmm. him. So the two of us collaborated on a question of how certain kinds of animals coordinate their activities, some with nerves and some without nerves, because what we first demonstrated, and I've always been very proud of being part of that with Mackey, was to demonstrate that epithelial conduction is a reality in selenorates. That means that they have conduction of impulses, of information, what we call, if it was a nerve, we call it a nerve impulse, but we have information passed from cell to cell mm-hmm. in an epithelial surface and without having nerves. Mm. So you can have non-nervous conduction. Mm-hmm. And this is a role of part of the animal that is not otherwise thought of as being component of behavioral regulation. And so
That's interesting.
Epithelial conduction was, I would think, one of the most important things that I worked on in my career with Mackie.
And with the publications came from
and
that.
And publications.
I think the next question, I think you just answered it. What do you consider to be your single most important contribution to your field? Would that be that, or is there something else?
I think that I made a contribution. Not I was not the only one who made this, but I was an important contribution in figuring out how to detect and record the electrical signals that were associated with behavioral coordination.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these involved nervous system, and some of them involved non-nervous epithelial system. And so I was interested in comparing the different kinds of solenoids and how they mm-hmm. arrived at these coordinating systems somewhat separately. There have been different pathways of production, and solenoids are among the very oldest of all of the phylum of animals, the Precambrian. So we, in trying to understand how the nervous system arose and how animals became behaving animals that we think of as being an animal that moves mm-hmm. and responds to environment in a positive way, as opposed to plants that are sort of passive, these coordinating systems were what I was mm-hmm. most interested in, mm-hmm. and looking at the comparison between the different kinds mm-hmm. of solenoids. So I've followed that up even to the present time.
That's great.
So that's my contribution.
Let's talk for a little bit about teaching. Now you said that you made a significant choice at.
I think I made it at two points. First of all, I became involved with Marion Meyer.
Marion Meyer.
In
team.
In teaching the comparative physiology course.
Now, you taught that collaboratively?
We did. We collaborated on it for many years, and it was a very valuable collaboration for me. Primarily, I was the lecturer. Mm-hmm. I did the lecturing. And she was primarily the laboratory chief.
Mm-hmm.
But we both participated in both things. Mm-hmm. We both attended all the lectures. Mm-hmm. We both attended all the laboratories.
Oh, yeah.
We taught ourselves. We really? Worked together mm-hmm. throughout this entire many years of development of this course as a synchronized and mm-hmm. coordinated activity between the laboratory activities mm-hmm. and the teaching and the lecture activities.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very proud of that,
yeah.
and I admire Marion for what contribution she made too.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, and she threw herself into it. Mm-hmm. She's very interested in undergraduate teaching and teaching graduate mm-hmm. students how to teach. So we were involved in that as well. But mm-hmm. primarily, we collaborated on this in this course and mm-hmm. this teaching. Then I taught a graduate level course for a few years on. Behavioral physiology, which tried to take students who'd already had a course in animal behavior mm-hmm. and then to integrate that with comparative physiology mm-hmm. and another level of understanding. Mm-hmm. And I think I went into that a little too late because I was not really able to make that course as mm-hmm. good a course as I had hoped, but I had tried on that. And then I decided, well, let's forget that. Maybe you should really go to a new kind of course. And at that time, a member of the department had been denied tenure, and she had left the department because of denied tenure. And she left behind a course that she had been teaching for undergraduates who did not have biology as a prerequisite or as a primary course. So it was a course of zoology for non-majors.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice challenge.
And I decided that was going to be a challenge for me because basically no one was going to tell me what the course had to consist of. It was complete blank page. What am I supposed to teach? No prerequisites,
that I have to meet. There are no goals that I have to. These people that are terminal in biology, you see. So I'm just supposed to take a semester in which I try to teach whatever biology I think undergraduate should have. Well, that was a wonderful, wonderful challenge. You see, I mean, no one was telling me what to do. I said, well, what do I have to teach? Oh, it's up to you. So I wrote out my own thing and never had to answer to anybody else. So I could spend a week talking about birth control, which I thought was important, or I could spend a week talking about the theory of evolution and why it was critical to biology. I could take a week or two talking about the understanding of DNA and how this evolved in biology. So I could take any subject that I wanted, you see. And the only commonality was this something that an educated citizen should know about? So I enjoyed that course.
Great. And how long did you teach that?
I taught that for 10 years
ago. Now, the same as the course that you taught with Marion Meyer.
Yeah.
These courses evolved throughout the passage
of
time.
Well, they did. But that was a course that I, at the end of my teaching, I really enjoyed very much because I felt that I could make the decisions about what it was going to be in it, and then I could present it any way I wanted to. And I had some. I remember one class where I arrived with a large test tube and a condom. I showed them. I didn't know anything more about this than they did, but or maybe less, I would say. But anyway, this was the kind of thing. It was sort of funny. But anyway, I really enjoyed that. And this development of this course, which so for the last decade of my teaching in Madison here, I had this course which has now worked itself pretty much into a pattern with Marion, but we continued to work on the labs and work to make them good, and the course for the undergraduates that could be anything I wanted to.
Now, when you first started teaching here, you taught the comparative physiology. What were some of the other courses that you?
Let me see.
That were thrown at you right off the bat.
Not very much, really. People were. They would say you have one undergraduate course to teach, and you have a graduate program of some kind. So I always had a seminar in physiology, a physiology seminar, and for many years Marion and I gave that jointly. I mean, we met. Our students collectively would come, and a few other people would drop in, and we would have this. Graduate seminar in physiology, and we choose a topic that we wanted to explore, and then go off and do that for the year. Well, that was
great.
Well,
that's great.
Very, very pleasant.
Yeah. How did your teaching evolve over time?
I think gradually I became more confident that I could do it. First year I taught as a graduate student. I mean, of course, I shouldn't say of course, but I was never given any formal training as a teacher in zoology. People just assumed that you would sort of learn how to do it, and then you would do it. And I went to Seattle, and the first semester I had to give a course in wasn't comparative physiology. I think it was just physiology as a junior level physiology course, mostly having to do with mammals and vertebrates. And the end of the semester, we had quarters actually. The head of the department said, "Well, you could have done worse. you were not elected as the worst teacher on the campus the last quarter. You were the second. You were runner up." But take your time and work it on a little bit more. Then when I went back to Yale to teach, I was teaching a course of invertebrate physiology, and I enjoyed that. And I had some very fine undergraduate students and several exceptionally good graduate students there. And then when I came here, my teaching was not very much in the beginning level. I remember at least
one year I gave some lectures in the biology course and so on. But people generally said, oh no, he has a big job in doing that senior course, which we think is important. And then when Marion came aboard and the two of us collaborated, that was even better from the department's viewpoint, because she was very interested in teaching and she could shape me a little bit better. So she taught me gradually. And I became more and more enthusiastic.
Yeah. And confidence is a big thing, isn't it? Yeah. You had a chance to observe undergraduates over a very interesting period in time in the 20th century. How did they change much over time?
Yes, they did. And they showed, I would say, decades maybe or short periods of when they were disinterested in the teaching that we were doing. They really couldn't dig it very much, and certainly when we had the National Guard out here on the campus.
Kind of hard to.
So to periods when they found it really very exciting, and the enthusiasm went up and down. And it was something that I found you could try to counter or build, but you could never really completely control.
Was it in basis of the stuff that was happening outside of the class? So in the 60s, it would have been late 60s, early 70s, it would have been less interest.
I don't want the words in my mouth. Then something new would come up in biology, and then they get more interested again.
And you could just kind of feel that rising and falling
so
wave.
It was not anything that you were responsible for, but you were essentially riding on it.
you were on top of that wave.
I think that was true, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know if that is a true insight or not.
No, that's my question. You also, how many students did you end up mentoring? I guess I had about
25.
Now, you mentioned a couple. Are there any other students that you'd like to talk about, just people that stand out in your mind for one reason or another?
Well, I had one student. Actually, the first graduate student I had when I was at Yale became a very successful researcher and leader in biology, and she was elected to be the head of the American Society of Zoologists before it changed its name. And so she was certainly one of my great students. And then she died of cancer. Her was cut short, which was a shame. I would say that she was one. And then I mentioned Dan Smith.
What was that woman's name?
Charlotte P. Mangum, M-A-N-G-U-M. She taught for many years at the University College of William and Mary.
Nice place.
Williamsburg.
So you mentioned Dan.
Daniel Smith, who was the person who worked on the sea urchins and then went back to computing. And has spent his life as a senior. Computer researcher in the industry, which is centered around Boston on Route 128, and that's where he works. And then I had this man, of course, when I was talking to you before, I could look back at the shelf in my library. I was talking to you in the library.
Oh yes,
and
right.
See all the names
right there.
So it's embarrassing that I didn't. A man named Michael Oberdorfer, who came to me and wanted to do some work, and he worked on several projects, but they didn't really work out. And then he found a person in the anatomy department who would supervise his work. So he got his degree under my direction officially, but actually doing an anatomy problem. And now he's spent a career as working at the NIH as a program director at NIH.
So not all of your students went into academe.
I had several students who
went to teach and spent their lives teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily, well, one went to Case Western Reserve,
mm-hmm.
and then had a teaching career there. Let's see, what else? You know, anyway.
Yeah, yeah, we don't have to go. I just wanted to get
several
of
them
sampling.
Went from Madison out into the state. I went and taught up at what's the name of the one up on the near Green Bay, not at the University of Wisconsin Green Bay, but at one of the university colleges or the state college state systems. Anyway, one of
Stevens Point,
Mackinac.
I think Manitowoc.
Manitowoc.
Yes, okay,
Manitowoc.
It's a 2-year school.
He went,
yeah.
He went to Manitowoc and taught there. And let's see. Well, anyway, these are the kinds of people.
Yeah.
I would
and the
say
kinds of jobs,
that
yeah.
I don't think that I ever really was a very, very effective graduate mentor. I felt that I was poorer than that because I expected students to be self-motivated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I know I was self-motivated.
Yeah.
When I went to graduate school, my professor, Talbot Waterman, would make an occasional suggestion, but he let me do my thing.
Right.
And that's what I felt that was the way other graduate students should do. But a lot of them didn't really work out.
That's interesting.
Anyway.
One very quick question. You mentioned that first woman who unfortunately died.
Charlotte.
She's a she. Yep. When did, were there a lot of women, did women begin to enter the field or were they already in?
They were already beginning and opportunities were opening up.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel, I told these students that they have to be aware that they're going to have some problem of getting positions,
mm-hmm.
but that I think that there will be positions opening for them. One of the students I had came to me as a postdoc and worked for me for several years as a postdoc and now teaches at the University of Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
And she's had a fine career, but
mm-hmm.
she's had to fight, you know, every career barrier, she's
mm-hmm.
had to sort of fight it out.
Figure out a way to
get over the hurdle. So it's not been easy for women, but I think it's easier, but it's still we still have problems.
Ways to go.
Yeah.
Wow. When and why did you decide to retire?
There were several things.
Running out of
finding that my teaching was becoming harder.
Mm-hmm.
It was becoming harder because I found I had more problems in trying to stay abreast of the changes in biology. And I was the last few years in teaching physiology, I felt that more and more acutely. That I'd have to go down and read Watson. Molecular biology of the gene, and try to understand it,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and try to integrate it into mm-hmm. the teaching that I was doing. But I didn't have that background,
mm-hmm.
you see. And genetics was becoming more and more a central thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was feeling myself more and more old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I found, I did not want to become a professor who kept talking the same way each year and becoming more and more obsolete.
Yeah.
I'd seen that. My colleagues,
yeah.
and I didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing. I was aware that biology was changing, and I was not able to really keep up with it. Then I went off for I had a semester off and leave, and I had a heart attack.
Mm.
Coming back, from that, it seemed to me, this is a, I did recover from it, and that was 12 years ago, and I feel that I have made a full recovery from that heart attack. But it slowed me down. I couldn't behave quite, I couldn't function quite as way I used to. My heart is only about 30% of a full efficiency now, but good enough. So that was something that was a awakening call for me. I took a semester off and then came back and taught again, but I didn't feel that this was really, that I was really functioning completely. And the third thing was that my wife was having emotional problems because she was being asked to do more administrative work and things in her department than she really felt she wanted to do or was good to do. And I decided that it would be best for the two of us if I took a retirement, I could convince her to take early retirement. And she did that, and she almost has convinced herself that she took an early retirement to take care of me, which is fine. I took a timely retirement to take care of her. Anyway, so that was a collective thing that we did. So those three things as way I came to retirement. And then we decided to move away from Madison, not because we didn't like Madison. We enjoyed very much the city. It's a wonderful place to live. But we thought it would be best for us both, and particularly for her, to make this break.
Yeah.
And we had started making a summer house out in the east. We fell in love with the community. We decided we'd like to live there. So it all worked out. It was very, very nice. So that answers your question.
Great. Last question.
Yeah.
Do you have any closing comments you'd like to make about your career at the University of Wisconsin?
Well, I made a mistake not coming here, or I made a mistake not coming to a place like this for 7 or 8 years.
I mean, yeah.
If I'd stayed at the University of Washington I would have had a fine career there. Mm-hmm. I would have been very happy. But I've never met my wife.
There's one of those things
one
we were
of those
talking about.
Yeah,
one of those serendipitous things, yeah.
But, so that was the mistake that I made of trying to go back and compete at the Ivy League level. I wasn't quite up to that kind of competition and willing to make the sacrifices that they wanted me to make. But I did a good fight, and I think I did pretty well. I'm not ashamed of what I did at Yale. They were stuck with me because they didn't know how to say no.
Right, yeah.
Because I'd done such a good job. I was really doing interesting research at that time. But they could, I think, also see that I was not quite the way they expected a person to be. So I came here and immediately decided that this was a place that I enjoyed. There were a few things that I didn't like. I mean, the Robert Bach as a head of the graduate school, I never thought I could trust him because I felt he was too much of an empire builder and so on. But, and the various chancellors and so on, and the deans all somehow had their own little things. But never mind. There were some good, very good people here. I never felt that I was not at a first-rate university. I was never embarrassed about saying I come from the University of Wisconsin, and they were supportive of me. They took me, and they took me for my failures as well as my assets, and let me find my way into a career which I was very satisfied with. So.
Mac, thank you very much. I am so glad that you called me yesterday, and we managed to get together and complete the interview in this fashion. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm sorry that I had to come here in person to do my job.
No.
and good luck to you in trying to figure out all the ins and outs of academia,
well,
which are complicated and so on.
Well, let's call it a day.